Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we all woke up to headlines like this, that under the power granted by the Patriot Act, quote, U.S. is secretly collecting records of Verizon calls. Are you okay with that? Are they secretly collecting your calls? Harvard's Larry Tribe will join us then. How old is too old? A Michigan congressman is about to become the longest-serving member of Congress ever. The lead liberal and conservative on the Supreme Court are 80 and 77. So are there certain jobs where being old is too old? Marjorie?
Christopher Lydon joins us to argue that the Whitey Bulger trial is too much about Bulger as monster and not enough about the government corruption that aided and abetted him. Then it's another Ask the segment. This time, for all you T-Riders, it's Ask the MBTA's general manager, Beverly Scott, anything and everything you want to know about the MBTA. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
So last night, the Patriot Act was the subject of debate between Gabriel Gomez and Congressman Ed Markey. Today, it's being debated all over America. That's because we woke up to headlines like this, that under power granted by the Patriot Act, quote, the U.S. is secretly collecting records of Verizon calls. Specifically, Verizon has been ordered to turn over the National Security Agency every single day all business call logs between the U.S. and abroad, or wholly within the U.S., including local phone calls, according to the New York Times. Joining us to discuss whether this practice is legal and wise is the professor of constitutional law at Harvard Law School, the Carl M. Loeb University professor at Harvard itself. That would be Lawrence Tribe. Larry, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So the administration, Professor Tribe, calls this whole gathering of this information from Verizon a critical tool in protecting Americans from terrorists. Is it?
Well, it's really hard to know because the administration is being incredibly secretive about what it believes authorizes this sweeping and essentially unlimited surveillance of the identity of who is calling whom, how long the calls last, where they're made, everything except the words themselves in the telephone calls. There is a statute, a provision of the Patriot Act, Section 215 of the Patriot Act, in which Congress, writing very broadly, said that the FBI could apply for orders from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that would authorize this kind of thing, but it's not a case where the court is given any particulars as to why particular individuals need to be watched or followed. It's a rubber stamp, essentially, and the rubber stamp that was apparently leaked to The Guardian and then to other newspapers is one that authorizes the United States government to find out exactly who calls whom and when on Verizon's business network services. Now, the same kind of order could be issued to Verizon with respect to cell phones, residential phones. There's really no limit. It could be issued to any other telephone provider. And the net result is that we are all subject to surveillance by Big Brother.
Hey, Larry Tribe, though, you used the word it could. An order could be directed to other carriers and to our cell phones and to our personal residential phones. It's not just could. It's possible it's going on now since
this is a secret court
and we just don't know about it.
That's right. Well, this thing is, in fact, labeled secondary order. For all we know, the primary order or the tertiary order covers all of those things. And the same rationale could be used, a very sweeping, unlimited reading of the Patriot Act and a very narrow reading of the privacy protections of the Constitution. It's really outrageous. And the thought that ever since 9/11, we could be subjected to this kind of overwhelmingly intrusive snooping by the government is something that's unsettling. And what's most unsettling is that some people don't seem too upset or surprised by it.
Now, Laura,
what I find interesting, not to bring in politics right away here, but you've written about this extensively, Professor Tribe, and other people have too. When George Bush was first doing these kinds of things right after 9/11, he was getting a lot of blowback, and we don't see that kind of blowback. We just heard Senator Dianne Feinstein defending what the administration is doing, say, well, it doesn't really matter that much because it's metadata.
Well, you know, a fancy word like metadata just hides the fact that they're finding out who you're calling, how long you're talking to them, and any special identifying information, the call duration, the time, and the place of the call. And Dianne Feinstein, as a senator whom I know and like, who's a member of the Intelligence Committee, might know things that would put people to rest, but we don't. And it's government of and by and for the people that I thought we signed up to.
You know,
under the Constitution.
Larry, you say we don't know. We're talking to Larry Tribe, Lawrence Tribe from Harvard Law School. One person who does know is a former student of yours, who I believe you described as the smartest student you ever had. So did Barack Obama miss your class on the Fourth Amendment, or what happened?
No, he was there, and he was brilliant. But he, of course, knows a lot of things that I don't know and that you don't know about the nature of the terrorist threat. But I don't think in a democracy we trust anyone, however brilliant they are, to make these decisions without any degree of transparency. And one of the things that President Obama has committed to is a more transparent government. But nothing could be more opaque than this sweeping kind of order. And had it not been leaked, and I'm confident that the administration is thinking about the possibility of figuring out who leaked it, had it not been leaked, this secret order issued in April for a three-month period with apparently indefinite renewals is something that is hidden in a black box. And I think that we should all be quite alarmed by the degree to which our privacy is compromised.
Larry Tribe, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and the act under which it was created, most of us only think about it every handful of months when there's a story. Can you go back and tell people who are listening, what is it? Why was it created? What power does it have? Is there any transparency at all? What's the deal with it?
Well, the deal is that after 9/11, the country was understandably concerned to maximize security even at some cost to liberty. And a very broad act, which was cleverly described as the Patriot Act, the acronym stands for some long sentence that I don't even remember, gave the government sweeping powers to figure out what books you take from the library, what calls you make. It set up this special court, which is a court only in name. It's not a court that hears arguments on both sides. It simply accepts the representations of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, set up this special court to grant orders to get all kinds of information. It's kind of ironic that the press gets incredibly exercised over the breadth of Attorney General Holder's subpoenas to the Associated Press reporters, but that's really child's play compared to this. This reaches millions, tens of millions of American citizens, and is essentially unlimited.
And their powers, I assume, orders of this Judge Roger Vinson, who of this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, these aren't appealable anywhere. I assume these are final determinations, unilateral determinations that can't be challenged. Is that correct?
That's right, and there'd be no basis on which to challenge them, because under the statute, all he has to do is accept the representations of the FBI that this is an investigation to protect against international terrorism or clandestine intelligence activities. But if you read the order, it doesn't recite a single fact that explains why such sweeping gathering of what is called metadata is necessary. There is a huge gap, and it's one that was importantly pointed out by Senators Wyden and Udall, between what the American people thought they were approving in the Patriot Act, which has all of these, it's called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and these are called business records. Between what they thought was being approved and what the Obama administration has secret legal opinions telling it was in fact being approved. And when we have essentially a government that is transparent in one direction, that is, they can see what we're doing, we can't see what they are doing, the underpinnings of government of and by and for the people are gravely jeopardized. So although President Obama, whom I admire and like and continue to believe was a great student, he's a friend of mine, but he is not immune to constitutional constraints. And I think that we are now in a situation where we need to know much more from the administration, from the White House, from the FBI, as to what the rationale is for this sweeping interpretation of government surveillance power.
We're talking with Lawrence Treiber, professor of constitutional law at Harvard Law School. You just said, Professor, that we need to know more about why the administration did this. But what you were saying previously led me to believe that they can just claim, hey, you know, this is a secret court. This is for to protect you from terrorist activity. We can't reveal information. And then we're stuck. Did I understand you or misunderstand you?
No, I'm afraid that's what the statute looks like. That's why the Patriot Act is regarded by many of us as so dangerously broad and opaque. But that doesn't mean that we, the American people, can't insist on better and more information. Unlike some other surveillance programs in which people have been tossed out of court because they couldn't prove that they were among the targets of the surveillance, anyone who is a subscriber to Verizon Business Network services just on the basis of the court order that has been leaked certainly can go to court and claim that he or she, or whatever small business or larger business they have, has been subjected to an order that makes transparent all of the calls that they make and to whom.
Larry Treiber, to complete the circle of secrecy, my understanding as well is the entity to which the order was directed, at least Verizon, and we don't know if it's other carriers, they're not permitted to answer any questions about this either. So if I called Verizon today and said, I want to know if you're sending a record of my calls or WGBH's calls to the National Security Agency, their answer is I can't answer, correct?
That's exactly right. The Patriot Act makes it an offense to give any of that information out. So essentially, it puts itself in a black bag, seals the bag, and says anyone who opens the bag and lets the cat out is a criminal.
Larry Treiber, last question for me. The only heartening part of this, and this is perverse, we spent a lot of time after the Marathon bombings talking about the massive collection of data by intelligence agencies and the lack of human power to analyze that data, and maybe that's what caused the breakdown leading to April 15th, you know, between the FBI and the so-called stovepiping and all that sort of thing. How do, when they get logs of every single business call at minimum that's been made via Verizon every single day, what ability do they have to analyze any of this stuff? How do they discern between the wheat and the chaff? How do they do this?
Well, of course, that's secret as well. There are secret protocols and algorithms and computer programs that enable them to filter the data, not necessarily accurately, but filter it in a way that reduces it to something that feels manageable, whether it's done the way the IRS apparently did it, by looking at ideologically tinged language, or whether it's done in some more neutral way, we don't know. But clearly, there's no human capacity to analyze all of the information. It creates an enormous web, and there are computer programs that detect patterns in that web, and hopefully the patterns will lead to greater security, but we don't know.
Larry Treiber, when the likes of you say to the likes of them, hey, listen, all you need is, and I assume you'd say this, if you have reasonable suspicion, or whatever the term of art is, to monitor someone's phone use, then go for it. But why do they need to do it when they have no suspicion, when one has done nothing that would put you in that category? What would their answer to that be?
Well, I think their answer would be, if you know what we know about how difficult it would be to separate the wheat from the chaff in advance and to figure out whom we should suspect, then happily we would put you in charge of protecting people from things like the Marathon bombing. But the fact is, we need to sweep more broadly, cast a broader net in order to provide necessary security. And I think gradually, inch by inch, people are getting used to invasions of their privacy and sacrifices of their liberty.
So I guess that means, Professor Larry Trout, that you don't think, and this is a political question too, but it's not a constitutional question, but you've been observing politics around here for a long time. You don't think there's any political stomach or any push to get rid of those most scary parts of the Patriot Act, I assume, do you?
I think at the moment, no. I think anyone who really wants to tighten things in order to protect privacy and liberty is going to be accused of being soft on terrorism.
Yeah.
I think that's a politically high cost to pay.
Hey, Professor of Constitutional Law at Harvard Law School, Lawrence Tribe, we really appreciate your time, Larry.
Good to talk to you guys.
Thank you.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Your last question to Professor Tribe, I think, is a perfect segue. The conventional wisdom, I know we both share it, is that post 9/11 and probably post marathon bombings, at least in this region of the country, the feeling is we're willing to sacrifice much more of our privacy rights, much more of our liberty in the name of protecting us. But we want to know at 877-301-8970 if you are troubled by what you just heard from Larry Tribe, what you read in this morning's newspaper, what you heard on National Public Radio. Again, every single day, the U.S. Verizon is turning over to the National Security Agency all business call logs between the U.S. and abroad, so that's where this foreign surveillance
right.
intelligence things come in, and all calls within the U.S., including local calls. And as Larry Tribe said, and as the New York Times story said, and as the Guardian story said, there is no reason to believe that it doesn't just include Verizon, but includes AT&T and all other carriers.
Don't say that.
Why not?
I was taking some small solace in the fact that I'm a Sprint customer
okay,
and all
fine.
My suspicious calls
You're
were.
Probably covered, too. And number two, is there any reason to think they started with business calls and don't extend it to residential phones, cell phones, all this sort of thing? And but this is so massive, and it really gets to what you and Larry Tribe were talking about. Our tolerance for this sort of stuff is so huge, and we read about it so regularly, even though this is about as massive as I've heard anywhere, that it's sort of like, okay, fine, next story. You know, it's the Associated Press last week. It's this week, on and on. This is the way the world is. This is the way the United States is in 2013. This
and
is
again,
really scary stuff.
The politics of this are really fascinating, because who were the big people objecting to the Patriot Act right after 9/11? Who are those people?
The liberals,
exactly.
obviously.
Exactly. And now we have the guy that you think of, the transparent president, the more liberal president, although he's turned out to be obviously a more centrist president, doing this thing from his presidency. And you heard Dianne Feinstein, like I said before, who's a good longtime Democrat, good liberal Democrat, defending the president of the United States.
We should say one thing about Feinstein. When you heard that sound bite
that
a couple
was
of minutes
metadata,
ago.
Metadata. We shouldn't be worried.
That's right.
As opposed to having the names and numbers of the calls. But it's,
No, excuse me. They do have the names.
The numbers.
What they don't have is content, she says. But how do we know that that's true? And even if it isn't true, as Larry Tribe said, if they know who you called, what number you called, how long you were on the phone with that person, I'd say that's pretty intrusive stuff too, isn't it?
Well, they can put together, if you have all the records of your phone calls, they can put together what you're doing all day long. I mean, was the lieutenant governor who refused to turn over his cell phone records? Jim Murray, is he a Verizon customer or a AT&T? Do we know that?
877-301-8970. We're particularly interested. We want to hear from anybody. We're particularly interested in hearing from people who say, this is no big deal. I want to be protected. I agree with the Obama administration. This is a tool they need to protect us from terrorism.
And we just got an email, and our email address, by the way, is bpr@wgbh.org. We got an email from Stephen, who says, interestingly, all the Verizon calls are being collected by a small plane circling above Quincy, Massachusetts. And the reason Stephen points that out is because there were small planes circling around Quincy in the wee hours of the morning, waking people up, getting the dogs barking. And there was no explanation from the government. Well, unless I've missed it, there's been no explanation from the government about what they were doing, why they were doing it, how long they were doing it. I mean, this is an increasing pattern we're seeing. We're seeing it now with the Whitey Bulger trial, and we're seeing it now with the Tsarnaevs, the bombers.
How are we seeing it in the Whitey Bulger trial? What do you mean?
It's Christopher Lysen's whole point that we're not getting a thorough vetting of the FBI's aiding and abetting Whitey Bulger for all his years of running wild all over Boston. And we still don't know what happened in Orlando with that young man that was killed by the FBI. Was he armed? Wasn't he armed? Why were there 7 shots? So this is a repeated pattern of government secrecy, and we just seem not to be that concerned about it, apparently, because we're not yelping about it. Our numbers are 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. What do you think? Is this okay if they're protecting us from terrorists, or is this a step or several steps too far? Let's go to Pete from Southborough. Hi, Pete.
Hey, So I wanted to say, I know Jim is talking in the sense of the royal we, in saying that post 9/11 we are more tolerant of a loss of privacy for security.
We, I mean, yeah, royal we meaning American society.
I am definitely uncomfortable with this lapse of personal privacy. I mean, not just a lapse, but a total overreach. And also, I want to say that it's not just that we should be kind of wary and angry, I guess, with the NSA, but with our elected representatives who have continued to allow this to go on and are doing all these votes continually in secret. And the fact that this has gotten out, I mean, of course, they kind of have some egg on their face, but I mean, that egg on their face is kind of the least of their worries in terms of just the foundation of this country.
By the way, I'm not so sure they do have egg on their face. I think they do. You think they do. But unless I'm wrong, Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California, from San Francisco, I think is the Democratic chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, the top intelligence member of the United States Senate. And
I mean,
you just heard her. Wait, wait, let me finish.
Really
let me finish.
Party by party.
Pete, let me finish, please. A couple of seconds ago, we heard her defending this and saying, don't worry, be happy. There's no content. So I don't, it seems to me, she doesn't feel that her face is covered with anything.
But with the technology that has been developed in the past couple of years regarding, like, algorithms for pattern recognition and basically it's incredible what we are allowed to know, never mind what is basically being produced by DARPA in terms of the information that they can kind of finagle out of just the call times, the number to number thing.
I agree completely.
And it's just incredible, like, what can be weaseled. I don't want to say weaseled, but I can't think of the right synonym.
I like weaseled.
And what can be? Yeah, exactly. But it's incredible the amount of really personal and large and scary information that can be finagled out of just things that you would think were benign.
Pete, thank you so much for the call. I think we're in relative agreement with you. 877-301-8970. One of the points that Pete made is how I feel. I want to hear people who represent me at least ask tough questions about this. Maybe at the end of the day, it is needed. I doubt it. That brought a sweep to protect us from terrorism. But at least stand up today and ask questions of the administration.
Well, here's someone on the other side. Mike from Attleboro just emailed and said, I don't care one whit about this non-story. No one wants to see how the sausage is made. People go ballistic when they get a nibble of what the government does in our post 9/11 world. Then all they do is moan and whine about the TSA, enhanced interrogation, whatever. Orwell's always been around. He just takes different forms as technology and needs change.
By the way, our favorite satirist, Marjorie and mine, is Andy Barowitz, who writes the Barowitz Report. Today, he drafted a letter to Verizon customers from the President of the United States, and in part it reads, to save my time and yours, here are answers to three frequently asked questions. I'll give you the first one. Will I be charged extra for this service? I'm happy to say the answer is no. While the harvesting and surveillance of your domestic phone calls were not a part of your original Verizon service contract, the National Security Agency is providing the service entirely free
of
charge.
Well, there you go. There's an upside.
He's a genius.
Your bill is not going to go up $10 to pay for this stealing of all your stuff by the... And you know what else is really scary about
What's
this,
that?
Too? That Verizon, a big, huge corporation, has been hauled in, at least figuratively, and said, you can't... We're taking all these. You're going to hand over all your stuff, but you can't comment on whether or not.
Not only cannot comment, you can't. Right, you can't acknowledge whether it happened
exactly.
or didn't happen.
So
essentially,
really,
the circle of secrecy is totally complete.
Well, you think of the power of big corporations, and in this case, Verizon. I bet they don't like this. I would assume. And yet they're totally, you know, under the thumb of this secret operation.
You know, talking about how we are sheep, and we'll get back to your calls
we
in one
sheep.
Second. Let's assume we found out today, which we do not know. Let's assume we found that it is solely Verizon customers
right.
who are being monitored, and it's residential and it's as well and personal as well as mm-hmm. business. Do you know one Verizon customer who would call and say, "I'm getting rid of my Verizon phone.
Well,
I'm switching to some other carrier."
To switch,
exactly.
I had a little snafu with Sprint. I called to ask. I was mad. I asked how much it's going to cost. Well, it's going to cost me $300 to get out of one contract and $200 to get another. It was like $1,000 if you're on the family plan.
But it's like, my point is, it's a pogo-esque kind of thing. And we are our own worst enemies, too. Let's go to Paul and Milton. You're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about this huge collection of phone information by the National Security Agency. Hey there, Paul.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. We probably are already being charged to collect this information.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point.
That's right. That's right.
You know, but I want to delve in and hopefully link it in to Maria Sacchetti's column in the Metro section of the Globe today, FBI tight-lipped on the Tadashev killing. And the thing that stands out to me is, and if I can quote it directly, the county medical examiner in Florida has refused to divulge the cause of death at the FBI's request, even though Tadashev's family has released photos of his bullet-ridden body. In other words, they will not release the autopsy report.
Yeah, but wait, don't just stop there. But the point of Sacchetti's piece today is that she compared it to other situations where the FBI have killed a suspect or someone they're interviewing, and she makes the point that in almost every circumstance, they immediately tell the public every detail they have. Here, as you say, they're not even answering whether or not there were seven shots, as the father has said, based upon the autopsy report. So there's been total secrecy. It's true.
It makes me wonder whether Whitey Bulger is still running the FBI.
Good line,
well,
Paul. Thanks for the call.
The situation in Orlando is enraging to me. I don't know. I'm wondering, was it always like this? I don't think so. It seems to me things were much more forthcoming.
Speaking of that, by the way, and speaking of healthy skepticism, Paul, thank you for the call. In light of the fact they won't give us any information, and the two people who we're now led to believe are responsible for the triple murder in Waltham are both dead, are you buying hook, line, and sinker the notion that the older Tsarnaev and Tadashev, the guy killed in his apartment in Orlando, are the killers of those three men in Waltham?
Well, Jim, I don't know what to think. I'm very, very upset by this. It's just, and especially in the context of the Whitey Bulger, when you reread these books and you realize what went on for 20 and 30 years with the FBIs, how the FBI basically set people up to get murdered because Whitey Bulger was their guy and Whitey Bulger went out and killed them. I mean, that went on for decades. And this thing in Orlando is just outrageous. I mean,
but if there was a poll today of Americans, do you think the average American, and I shouldn't say this without seeing the polling data, but I'll do a conjecture here. My guess is there is not healthy skepticism amongst most people. No matter how much we read and hear, the conventional wisdom is if the government says someone's a bad guy, they're a bad guy. If the government says we need to be protected from terrorism by doing X, even though it may seem excessive, then we have to do
Jim,
X.
I told you, I gave a little talk a couple of weeks ago to the Women League of Women Voters.
I know you did, yeah.
They're very engaged women in politics, and mm-hmm. I was talking about government secrecy. I don't think my talk went over very well.
What is it? What do you mean?
I just don't, because
they're more trusting? Is that your point?
Yes, and I think people were saying, they were defending the Department of Justice, some of the people that I spoke with, going after reporters' records, and they were defending the government holding these things close to the vest mm-hmm. because of security or because of confidentiality. And I've said this a million times, but my experience as a reporter is when the government says, even small g government, like little town government, says, well, I can't tell you that because of it's a personnel matter or it's a confidentiality matter, many times it's not that at all. It's that they look bad releasing the information. So we use these excuses.
But occasionally you're part of the problem. We've had discussions through the years where you have said things like, well, if you have nothing to hide, then what's your problem if they do a search, if they do whatever? The problem is your life can be intruded upon even if you've done nothing to raise any suspicions about anything. That's not freedom, Marjorie.
But that's different, though. I don't mind people having security cameras on the corner of Commonwealth Avenue and Harvard Street.
Because it's a public place.
Because it's a public place. I don't want people looking at
my
phone records.
You're right.
And I don't want reporters to have to file Freedom of Information Acts to get legitimate information back from their government or charging people $800 and $1,500 to get that information either. It's just outrageous. And they do it more and more now.
Let's go to Nick in the car. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey there, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent. Thanks for the call.
So right now, it's just raw data. And I ask you this. Would you not want to know who others are associating with if someone is a known jihadist? Would you not want to say, gosh, this guy is a known bad guy? I'd like to figure out who else this person is associating with and communicating with so they can do further investigation.
But Nick, that's the thing. If there were probable cause to believe somebody was a jihadist, I mean, we all know they had all sorts of information about the Tsarnaev brothers that they didn't use, tragically. That's different than looking at every business's phone records or possibly every individual's phone records across the board. That's the problem.
So the answer is the way you stated it. We totally agree with you. If you reason to believe someone's a known jihadist, then go for it. And don't you appreciate the irony, Nick? We're not going to hang up. I just want to make this point. Don't you appreciate the irony that we knew there were problems with Tamerlan Tsarnaev and we didn't follow up on him? Millions of these people whose phone records are being looked at have done nothing wrong, and we are following up. I mean, isn't that the ultimate sickness in terms of privacy and security and all that sort of thing? Nick?
I can see your point, but if you already have access to this kind of raw data and you're able to immediately capitalize on it once you identify that someone is doing something that's illicit, then you're going to be able to take action on it more quickly than if you then have to go and investigate it.
Well, of course you are.
And then go. And of course, you know, you do have certain privileges through things like the Freedom of Information Act so that you can find out what someone may be saying or investigating about you.
Excuse me, Nick, in this case, and that was the point we made with Lawrence Tribe, you have no right to know any of this. And had someone not leaked this information to The Guardian, we wouldn't even know that this surveillance existed. So you have no right. If you tomorrow did an FOIA, Freedom of Information request, or called Verizon, or called your congressperson or senator and said, I want to know if my business is covered by this, their answer would be, I don't know, and I can't tell you. I mean, that's part of the problem. If you could learn whether you were covered or not, then I guess some of us would have less of an objection. We really appreciate your call, Nick. Thank you for making it.
Ted is emailing. He says, what if this big brouhaha is just a smokescreen and the government wants us to be focusing on this issue when there's something more serious going on?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not at that. So he thinks the government is leaking this information, so we obsess on this. The problem is we're not going to obsess on this. You and I are, and maybe some of the listeners are. This is like water over the whatever it is. For most people, it's yet another example. No harm, no foul. Let's move on.
Let's go to Ben in Hingham. What do you think, Ben?
How are you people? I haven't talked to you in a long time.
Yes,
we're thrilled
hello,
to hear
Ben.
Your voice, Ben. Thanks for the call.
This is the non-commercial Ben.
Ben. Yes, that's a good line. Go ahead, Ben.
All my friends accuse me of listening to Fox News in my off time. Actually, I listen to NPR.
Great. Terrific.
That's our little secret. But anyway, I'm one of those people who ordinarily would be bothered, not because I'm paranoid about the government, which I'm really not. But I'm a purist in terms of what was the most chilling was hearing Larry Tribe saying what he was saying, because I know he knows what that means, and that is scary stuff. I think that the reality is that we have an enemy who's very, very smart, and they're using our Constitution as an Achilles heel. The bottom line is that they have to do this stuff from a practical sense right now. This, you know, I hate to be harping on this, but this is when the credibility of the government is absolutely essential. And when you have a situation where you've got somebody going on TV and the Sunday morning talk shows and lying to you, and then they're saying, but trust us here, it won't work. We needed cooperation, because if we do this properly, we won't have to do this forever. And I think we have to monitor it. It has to be done very carefully. But the trust thing is just critical.
So, Ben, if you were to learn in tomorrow morning's papers that not only were they receiving logs of every single business call made on Verizon, but they were receiving logs of every single personal call made on any phone carrier, you wouldn't be troubled by that?
Well, I'll tell you, that wouldn't bother me as much, and I'll tell you why. Being in the information business, if you have too much information, if you've got more information than you can handle, it doesn't really tell you anything. What I'd be much more scared about is if they were monitoring me for content. If they were simply trying to monitor a pattern, and they were doing it across the board, the same way that in airline security is that they're... I mean, I remember coming home from Phoenix and being in Detroit in an airport, and a little old lady and myself were essentially cavity searched getting on a plane, and everybody else just kind of walked through. if it's random and if everybody's subject to it, it's a different thing than if you're being targeted.
Ben, I hear, but let me tell you, I have to say, believing as you do, and maybe a lot of people do, that they're not monitoring content because they say they're not monitoring content, and because Dianne Feinstein says they're not. Frankly, in light of the fact doing this at all, it doesn't convince me. Ben, we're really thrilled to hear from you again. Stay in touch with us. 877-301-8970. I mean, I think we've heard a pretty good sample so far of people who say this is what you have to do in the era in which we are living, no?
Well, you referred to the NOVA special where we had all these different agencies collecting these massive amounts of information and not being able to do anything with them in many of the cases.
Or choosing not to do anything with them.
Or choosing not to do anything. I mean, I think this is just total government overreach, and I'm not convinced at all that it's keeping us any safer. I mean, I know that a lot of great intelligence has been gathered and has thwarted a lot of plots since 9/11, but I'm not at all convinced that taking – I mean, what are we talking about? We don't even know. Is it hundreds of businesses, thousands of businesses, tens of thousands of businesses?
I would assume it's millions. It's every single one that uses Verizon Business Service. That's what we know of, every single one.
So if we know already that Temerlin Tsarnaev and his mother were talking about jihadist events on the phone, mm-hmm. and we did nothing about that. If we're talking about this massive mountain of information, and who knows what the needles are? I mean, that's what's crazy about
this. I agree.
Well,
that's what I was trying to ask Larry Tribe of. The answer is we don't know what the criteria are for choosing certain calls over others. Let's go to Newton, where Susan's on the phone. Good morning. Good afternoon, Susan. Welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Good morning. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
I have to say, I think we're barking up the wrong tree as usual. I think that looking at Verizon, the only value of announcing to everybody that we're looking at Verizon is to tell us that what it's going to do is warn the people who are on Verizon to switch companies. So they're going to immediately switch companies to some of these lesser known ones. And if, in fact, that's what they're doing, what they should be investigating is who is jumping the wagon right now.
Well, you know, that may be the case, but Susan, I think it's naive on anybody's part to think that we happen to have heard about Verizon this morning. Why would they have picked Verizon? Why terrorists prefer Verizon? My assumption
is... That's going to be their new ad.
Exactly. My assumption is they're doing everybody, and all we heard about this morning was Verizon, don't you think?
No, my assumption is that, truthfully, they're assuming that these people are run-of-the-mill people. They're coming in from other countries, and they're buying SIM cards, and they're plugging them into their old phones, and it has nothing to do with Verizon or anybody here. I think that they're really looking in the wrong direction, as usual.
Susan, thank you for the call. I have to say, many of our listeners are far more content with this than you and I apparently are.
No, I don't like it at all. I think you're getting very close to the Fourth Amendment, you know, unreasonable search and seizures. This gives me the creeps. I don't like any secret courts. I don't like that we don't know what these courts are doing, who's working for them, where they're sitting. I think this is all very scary stuff.
Let me just say one thing to you to just sort of close this conversation without disclosing any details. Mm-hmm. A couple of the calls you were on last night were so long. I looked at your calling plan. And I want to leave it at this. You're going to exceed your limits. I would suggest you just tighten them up a little bit or maybe just email Marjorie.
Okay, Jim. Thank you very much.
Moving on.
If you guys watched last night's debate between Gabriel Gomez and Congressman Ed Markey, I'm not sure how many people did, but if you did, if you're a good citizen and voter of Massachusetts, you know that Gabriel Gomez made Markey's 37-year career in Washington a serious strike against him. So, is there a problem with growing old and too old on Capitol Hill and every place else? Should we have age limits in Congress? Should we have age limits in your job? That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio 89.7.
I'm Ibi Caputo. I live here and I report here. I found out where the Boston bombers lived was on my own street.
The normalcy was stunning, given that the street had been cordoned off to residents.
When I was reporting for WGBH Radio from my own block, it really brought home the synergy between living in a community and working in that same community.
FBI, police, and SWAT teams did their
Ibi
work.
Ibi Caputo, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you. And Seasons 4, the outdoor living store in Lexington, featuring a large selection of plants, statuary, and garden accessories, plus over 100 styles of outdoor furniture, on Mass Ave in Lexington and online at seasons4.com. And WGBH 44, your new home for the best in public affairs. Friday nights catch the McLaughlin Group at 9, followed by Need to Know at 9:30 and Moyers and Company at 10. Lively debate and fresh insights Friday on WGBH 44.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Question is simple. How old is too old? You know, just days ago, New Jersey United States Senator Frank Lautenberg died at 89. Sometime this week, and maybe today, Michigan's John Dingell Jr. becomes the longest-serving member of Congress ever, by the way, at 86. Well, airline pilots must retire somewhere around 65, some judges at 70. Many public safety officials have mandatory retirement ages, but most people can just keep doing it until they just can't do it. So our question for you is, how old is too old, and what lines of work is it appropriate to set age ceilings and essentially to mandate that an individual steps down? Our number is 877-301-8970. What's your take on this?
Well, I think, of course, a talk show host should be able to go on indefinitely and be on the record about that. But I think in politics, I mean, when you think of Strom Thurmond that was 100 years old when he retired, that seems to be a little bit old. And the John Dingell case is almost a little bit sad because he was a very robust, no-nonsense kind of guy, 6'3". Now he's very stooped over, walking with a cane, sometimes in a wheelchair. There's some question about how well he can – his mind is sharp, but let's face it, it's not as sharp as it used to be. Lautenberg is 89. You're getting up there.
So what's the end, of the sentence? You have a mandatory retirement. You can't be a member of Congress after what age?
You know, I'm for term limits in Congress.
Yeah, but forget term limits. But forget term limits. We don't have term limits. Assuming that while term limits couldn't get through, mandatory retirement ages maybe could. I doubt they could, but they could as a concept. 80 years old.
80.
Why? Just because you're picking the number?
Because I think people live a long time now. People do. We have members of the Supreme Court. Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She's 80 years old. She seems to be totally compos mentis, as far as I can tell. Scalia
is 77.
77. I don't think he's lost a beat in terms of intellectual ability.
But see, there's another issue, though. I'm so glad you brought up the Supreme Court of the United States, where you could serve till you're 100. My concern there is not, can they still do their work? I think the evidence is that they can at 80 and 77. And I think John Paul Stevens may have been in his mid-80s. How old was Brennan when he retired? Sometime Justice Brennan was some age in his 80s. My issue
is, he was in his 80s.
Can they still do it? My issue also is, should they still be allowed to do it? And what I mean by that, for example, you have a Supreme Court, Marjorie, where a decent number of the members are in their late 70s and 80s, and they have to make decisions about the world in 2013. Does it concern you? I don't know what the average age of the Supreme Court is. I think I read a couple of weeks ago it's somewhere close to 70. Is that – even if they're all – 9 of them are still competent, even though we don't know from one because he hasn't spoken except for once in 9 years aren't you troubled by the fact that they've sort of aged out in terms of making decisions about contemporary America?
Someone, and I forget, so I can't give credit to the writer, pointed out that it is weird when you think that the average age in the United States Senate, the United States Congress, is so elderly that they're governing a world that is totally opposite.
That's my point.
From
exactly.
The world
exactly.
That, you know, that they grew up in and that they maybe understand. So I think you see this with the Republican Party in terms of social issues, too.
Did you see, by the way, did you see Dingell Jr., the one who's about to set the all-time record on Colbert earlier this week?
I heard about it.
Listen to this. This is John Dingell Jr. is about to become the longest-serving member of Congress ever, passing, what's the guy from West Virginia, Senator Byrd, on Stephen Colbert.
You've been in Congress longer than Hawaii's had a congressman.
And longer than Alaska.
Did you vote in Congress to include Hawaii?
Yes.
And so Alaska. We can blame Obama on you.
Stephen, would you give his father and mother a little credit?
That's a pretty good line from John Dingell, 86 years old. 877-301-8970. Marjorie,
yes.
You had foot surgery recently, right?
I did.
Did we talk about that on the air? I think we did. Well, whatever. But now we have talked about it on the air. Do you want your surgeon to be 77 years old?
No, I get very nervous about that.
So,
you start to see the handshake. You know what I mean? You say, I don't know if this is the way I want
to
go.
But what most people would say is it's an individual issue. If it's 77, your hands are secure, your eyesight is good, operate away.
I'm a big fan of older people in a lot of professions. I mean, older lawyers, great, because they have massive experience. I like older physicians, massive amounts of experience, too.
A lot of people say same with legislators, by the way.
Well,
Ted Kennedy, a la John McCain. John McCain's 76 years old, Marjorie. Mm-hmm. Would you have term limit him out?
Well, he's made a few odd remarks.
Okay, fine.
877-301-8970.
This is all provoked by, again, the death of Frank Lautenberg at 89, John Dingell Jr. becoming the longest-serving member of Congress. He's 86. And also, frankly, while age was not the issue, Gabriel Gomez, his major line of attack against Ed Markey, who I think is 66, not sure, is you've been in Congress 37 years. It's a variation on the same theme. It is time to go.
I mean,
even though he's not contending he's too old, he's just contending he's been too long at the fair.
Generally speaking, I think the problem is the other end. I mean, I think that we're retiring too early, especially if you're in government when you're retiring at 55 years old. That is too early because you're living, most people happily are living into their mid-70s.
You've had that discussion with Deval Patrick. What do you say about state cop retirement? What do you always say to the governor?
That I think if you want to retire at 50, that's fine. I think you can get a desk job. I don't expect to be running down the Mass Turnpike after people or jumping over fences or anything, police officers in general, not just state cops. But if you want to retire at 50, I don't think you should be able to get your pension until you're 65 because it's too much of a burden on the property taxes and the tax. We can't afford it is when people live longer than they put into their pensions.
Let's see what people think. Our number is 877-301-8970. Again, you don't have to limit yourself to judges or members of Congress or state legislatures. Let's talk about the world at large. Let's start in Cambridge with Kim. Hey, Kim.
Hey, I have 3 points to make.
Please.
Okay? One, if you can do the job with a reasonable accommodation, then you should be able to keep your job, okay? Number two, if more generations now than ever are in the workplace, I mean, I'm at the tail end of the baby boomer, so I'm in my late 40s, and I feel like I'm just rolling now as far as my career goes. And I've had some issues with some younger workers who have made mention of my age. And you know what? That just really ticks me off because I have a great mind and my body still works and I do a great job and I have this great thing called life experience, okay? Mm-hmm. And number three, isn't age a protected class?
Well, in certain settings, it is. Ageism, there's been a lot of litigation. Marjorie, you wrote about a famous case of alleged age discrimination in the TV industry locally a couple years ago, a former colleague of ours on our former radio station.
Jim.
The answer is yes. But in government, for example, there is a mandatory retirement age for judges on lots of levels. But let me ask you, Kim, even though every point you made, I don't want to speak for Marjorie. I think both of us agree with everything you said. How would you feel if the Supreme Court of the United States, if all nine members were in their 80s, and they were to make a decision that affected your life in your 40s, isn't that a problem? Even if they're all still competent, they're still with it, isn't that an issue there?
Well, is there no other way to do that? I mean, is that the only way for them to make that decision? They're the only people qualified.
Well, yeah, they are the only people. I mean, they are under our Constitution. They're the final arbiters of a lot of things, that, including whether or not somebody can have an abortion, whether or not affirmative action is to exist, whether or not Bush beats Gore or vice versa. So the answer is they do. All I'm saying, your basic point about competence, I think, is one that virtually everybody agrees with. But I don't think the issue is always just how capable someone is at an older age. But, Kim, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
So where are you on this? Should we make the Supreme Court retire?
Yeah, absolutely.
How old?
In the case of some, I'd say 40. 45. No.
Well, Roberts is the youngest.
I don't know what the answer is.
And he's going to be close to 60.
Robertson,
himself.
Yeah. I think mid-50s? He's in his 50s. I think he's in. And by the way, he was also a student of Larry Tribe,
That's
who joined
right.
us both. I think the answer is 70 is fine. I don't know. Could you convince
70?
Me at 72? It was some age.
Why 70?
I don't know.
That's
Why'd
too young.
Okay, 74. You asked me if I thought there should be retirement age. Yes, I do.
They don't have to be vaulting over anything. They're sitting at their desk using their heads. I think
if they retire from the Supreme Court, let them serve as visiting judge. I'm not saying they should retire from life or retire from their work. It's just there's certain settings. And again, maybe there should be a rebuttable presumption. We were talking about surgeons a couple of minutes ago.
Yeah.
I'm sure we're upsetting a lot of doctors up there. Let's assume you picked an age there. Let's say it was 70, for argument's sake. 75, after which you have to do some testing, some something to show that there's a, I mean, the answer is there can be creative work, both in the private and public sector, to get to a reasonable conclusion. Air traffic controllers, you know how old they can be? 56. You don't think someone can, I think it's 56. You don't think people can be totally together and on top of things at 58 or 60 or 62?
Yes, I do. I think
well, that's
ridiculous.
What the determination was there.
That they can retire.
There's some exceptions to allow them to work to 61. But essentially, this is going to become more of an issue because people are living longer. People, because of gerrymandered districts, for example, and at mm-hmm. least the House side of Congress, people can serve there their whole lives if they choose to. It becomes an issue.
Pilots is interesting. They're 65. The air traffic controllers are younger.
Yeah.
I can see pilots at 65.
That's an interesting point.
I know. That's one of your great fears, isn't it, that something happens? But you can walk in, you see a pilot that looks a little older, you think, oh my God, hope he doesn't have. You want to see a young co-pilot.
You know
right
what you say in that
in
situation? I'll take the train. Let's go to Jerry is in Dover. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for the call.
Good afternoon. It's interesting that you mentioned state police and age 50, because the state police used to have a mandatory age 50 until the merger of the various other mm-hmm. places in 93. And then the state police union worked to eliminate any mandatory for state police, which means that you can be 70 years old and be on Troop F in the airport. And, of course, you can ask yourself about what the security level is then.
But wait, let me be clear. Is that the case now, Jerry? Is that mandatory retirement age for a state cop?
That's correct.
Okay.
And conversely, they forced into the legislation in Mass General Laws Chapter 32, they snuck it in, a statement that now reads, and has since 94, that there is mandatory retirement at age 65 for all uniformed municipal public safety officers. The suspicion was they were aiming at the Boston Police Patrolmen Association. They hit the firemen as well.
Let me guess that you're one of those people. Is that a safe assumption?
A retired firefighter and still 5 years later, mad as heck is about it.
You sound it, and you probably should be.
Jerry, let me be clear. What is the age of retirement for firefighters?
For all uniformed municipal public safety officers, it is 65.
Okay, I thought it was younger than that.
And capability. And that's, of course, the whole point. You know, there are some guys who are in their 40s who can't climb a set of stairs.
Right.
And there are some of us who can run up three flights of stairs with 100 feet of hose and 57 pounds of equipment on our back.
But how many actually stay to 65? You hear, I mean, I think a lot of police and firefighters do retire earlier and often start second careers.
Well, second career is something you do during the while you're employed.
That's an excellent point.
Hey, Jerry, thank you for a fine call. So what's the presidential race where age was most central?
Ronald Reagan.
Right, exactly. Now, you know, when Ronald Reagan was elected the first time, he was the oldest, I believe the oldest president to take office. He's running against Walter Mondale, the Democrat, in 1984, and Mondale is making an issue of the age. So Ronald Reagan, at a debate, you've all heard this line, was asked by the debate moderator if his advancing age was an issue. Here it is.
I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience.
And by the way, the reason that was so great, if you've never
seen
it, is to his credit, unlike so many stiffs in politics, remember what Walter Mondale's response was? He was laughing his you-know-what off because he knew it was a great line by Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, we have a very creative suggestion from Stephen about the Supreme Court justices you were talking about, whether they should be mandated to retire at a certain age. Stephen says that we should make the justices drive themselves to work. If they make it without taking out a CVS along the way, they can still hear cases. That is a reference, of course, to the problem of elderly drivers driving through the CVS, literally.
Right. Into the pharmacy, that's right, directly, rather than parking outside. Our number is 877-301-8897, and we'll take a few more calls on this. We're talking about where mandatory retirement ages are appropriate, particularly in the public sector, but we've discussed a bit in the private sector as well.
Let's go to Cynthia in Rhode Island. What do you think, Cynthia?
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for making it.
Thank you. My opinion is this, that it should not be any age requirement for any position, be it private sector or public. I think it all should be based on capabilities, on performance reviews, on and especially, you know, when you're bringing up a point regarding Supreme Court justices not being in tune with the rest of the world, some people I know my age at 62 are not in tune with the rest of the world, and they still don't believe there's global warming. So I honestly, they do. I mean,
that's a good point.
And people younger than I am don't believe in it. So I'm like, you know, it's intelligence, it's education, it's an awareness, it's being part of your community, knowing what's going on around you.
But let me ask Cynthia, even if you're right, so what do? Do we have Supreme Court justices take a test at age 70 to see if it's whatever words you just used, intelligence, all those things? Is that, I mean, that's a pretty hard threshold to create, don't you think?
I Yes and no. I realize that there would be some impediments to that. I don't see why there couldn't be a board of review established. And the makeup of that board of review would be probably, you know, all walks of life. Oops, there goes my car. All walks of life, different capabilities, different experiences, et cetera, et cetera. So that would be an unbiased and fair assessment. I'm 62 years old. I'm highly educated. I have a good job. I know what I'm doing. But every year I get a performance review as to how I'm performing, and that's based on whether or not I get a raise, I get a bonus, I keep my job, and I think that should be just all the way throughout the entire country. I think
Cynthia said it well.
Should be applicable.
You said it very nicely, Cynthia. Thanks for the call.
You know, is there some reason, Jim, that you're picking on the Supreme Court here? Have you?
Yeah,
have there been senile judges that you're aware
of? No, but it is arguably the most. I don't want to sound like some lunatic, but they are the most powerful people in the United States. Some Supreme Court justices serve through. We have a democratic election,
right.
Small d, every 4 years to elect the president of the United States. Some of these men and women serve through four, five, six, seven elections.
Would you look at,
and have unlimited power?
William Brennan and Potter Stewart. They were both well into their 80s,
I don't know how
still
old
on the court,
was, yeah.
Were they disgraced themselves?
I don't think
so.
They were. But you missed my point. I'm not talking purely about inability to do a job, which is a real serious issue, how you deal with that if someone is infirm. But what are you going to do, impeach a justice? It's pretty tough, it seems to me. As I said, even if they're totally compos mentis, I'm not comfortable having, for example, 80-year-old white guys making decisions that affect America as it is in 2013. There's got to be more diversity. And one of the ways diversity matters, at least in my opinion, is age.
And yet you are not interested in any term limits, even though statistic today that only 12 senators are younger than 50 years old.
That's is that true?
Only 12 are younger than 50 years old, and they're going to stay there forever because, of course, you get more power with your seniority. So that's why we have so many guys that are like, you know, in their 80s in the United States Senate. Remember Robert Byrd? I mean, I think
he was the longest-serving senator before a member of Congress before John Dingell Jr.
Not sure if he. I know he died in his 90s. I'm not sure if he was. Did he die in the Senate or did he retire?
By the way, there's a perfect example. Again, I didn't see any testing. Remember one of his final speeches about dogs?
Yes, I do.
And it. I mean, it was a really
terrible.
Sad moment where it was pretty clear
was
that he should not be a United States senator.
That was attacking
Michael
the
Vick,
dogs,
right? Yeah.
Yes.
In any case, all right. That's it. We'll revisit this at some point in the future. But thank you kindly for your calls.
We do not want to retire yet, Jim. Is that correct?
No, if it doesn't apply to. Us, Marty. We're talking about other people, almost, you know, sort of like Congress. All the rules apply to other people. They don't apply to
us. Up next, Christopher Lydon weighs in on another old timer. That would be, of course, the 83-year-old Whitey Bulger and his trial. Stay tuned for Open Mic in 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH and the Boston Globe announced this year's Boston Summer Arts Weekend, presented by Citizens Bank. A weekend packed with live music and arts in Boston's Copley Square, the weekend of July 26th. More at bostonsummerarts.com.
If you've traditionally supported WGBH in August, you should know that WGBH's fiscal year now ends on June 30th. Help cover the costs of another solid year of news and programming with a gift in any amount at wgbhnews.org.
Funding for our programs comes from you and New England College of Business and Finance. NECB offers special benefits for employees of its corporate partners. You can learn more about the benefits of the NECB Corporate Partnership Program at necb.edu. And Mass Recycle, in partnership with Covanta Energy, providing information on proper disposal of common household products that contain mercury, as well as education on recycling. More at massrecycle.org/keepmercuryfromrising.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. This is Open Mic. You know, we've been following jury selection in the Bulger trial for 3 days, while Chris Lydon has been following Bulger and his sibling for three decades or more. He joins us every Thursday at 1 here
Am
to
I
give us his...
Am I disqualified by age? Is that what you're getting at?
Well, not yet. We'll see how you do today, and then we'll make a determination. Here to give us his take on the Bulger trial would be Christopher Lydon. Hey, Chris.
Good morning, Jim. Good day. I always say good morning.
I do the same thing.
I sleep too late, maybe. Marjorie, you had it right, Marjorie, in your column yesterday. I mean, the irony, the wonderful, delicious, era-changing irony of Whitey Bulger, known as, how we called him, the Caucasian, the white man, you know, at the mercy now of an African-American woman judge.
I love it.
I mean,
I love it.
The tables have turned. And it's, you know, it's the token of a completely new world. My beef with this trial, though, is that the trial, the whole structure of it, is out of the old world.
Meaning what?
Meaning that you can't call it a cover-up, but it's a containment trial. We're containing the damage. What do I mean by that? The FBI, above all, I think also William Bulger, must be protected. We will not go far afield here on looking at implications. We'll dwell entirely on the heinous, violent crimes of Whitey Bulger, without straying into his effect on the state house, his effect on city life, his effect on life on Broadway in South Boston.
How will we do that? If you were the judge or the czar, let's say, of this trial, this proceeding, how would you expand the scope to address the issues that you believe, and I think we agree with you, are being unaddressed here?
Well, you know, I was going to get to this, but let's go right for it. There are important precedents here. The main one from my childhood, really, was Charles Wysanski, federal judge, trying a corruption case involved contracting for the Mass Turnpike and William Callahan and all this sort of stuff. There was an engineering firm led by a guy named, kind of a well-born guy, Thomas Worcester, and he was not testifying. He was not cooperating with what had actually happened. And Wysanski threw the book at him. Basically, from the bench, not the prosecutor, he said, you're going away. You'll never see your grandchildren. You'll never... Basically, he threw a long sentence at him for not cooperating. And Thomas Worcester came around and completely revealed the whole story. Years later, funny thing, I knew Charlie Wysanski quite well. He was an amazing man, but an activist judge. He wanted to know what the hell is going on in the road contracting in the state of Massachusetts. This was 1960. Years later, I was interviewing about Elliot Richardson, who had been the prosecutor of the case, and he was this is Watergate time, and Judge Sirica had just put John, what's his name?
Dean?
The first of the CIA sort of thugs.
Whomever.
McCoy. James McCoy had gotten the long sentence because Sirica put him away until he talked. And Judge Wysanski said to me, looking back, he said, that's an outrageous abuse of the sentencing privilege to put a man away until he talks. But he said, it's exactly what I did in the Worcester case. It's what broke the Worcester case. In Boston, in the Bulger era, Charlie Wysanski's, you know, practically blood son, Judge Mark Wolf, a very, very brave, good judge, had this case before him. The feds took it away from him and put it before this Judge Casper, we spoke about.
Judge Stearns, in between, who had an FBI connection earlier in his life, which is why an appellate court took him off the case, correct?
Right, and was almost Bill Clinton's pick to be head of the whole FBI. But the real point is that they took the case away from Mark Wolf, who earlier ordered an extended investigation of the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's performance in the whole Bulger history. He is definitely out of the Wysanski tradition. He worships the memory of Charlie Wysanski. Back to your question, Jim, how could we have opened it up? He could have said, we're going to talk about an amazing phenomenon, a novel of endless detail and huge proportions that paralyzed the integrity or the civic life of this city for 30 years, and then open it up. They have done exactly the opposite.
Focusing laser-like on Bulger himself
and on the heinous, violent crimes. For example, they could have. Judge Casper has ruled, as I understand it, that there will be no discussion of Whitey's claim that he had a prospective immunity.
Correct.
From Jeremiah O'Sullivan.
U.S. attorney at the time, who's dead.
Now dead. She says it's a preposterous idea that he would have given it, and besides he's dead, so we're not going to hear on that. Well, the question I think Mark Wolf would have asked is, why not? Let's find out what we can about this deal. What was the understanding between the federal government, the FBI, and this, well, just so this people, Chris, criminal
Chris,
informant.
Okay. Just so people that may not know, because it, the way it went down with the Whitey Bulger case is that the state police, the local police, the DEA, all these other agencies wanted to nail Whitey Bulger, and
true,
the FBI was preventing them because their agents were on the take and getting money and gifts and so forth from Whitey Bulger, and he was an FBI informant.
Right.
So it was everybody in law enforcement against this corrupt FBI, just so people that may not know that, they haven't read the books.
You're good, Marjorie, and this is a very good question. Why wasn't this case taken first to a, you know, Suffolk Superior Court? I mean, lawyers have been said to me, this is a 3-week case. There's no question that he gets convicted and put away forever. If you want to kill him, put it first in Oklahoma. They had the death penalty,
right.
Try the Oklahoma murder case first. Again, it's a brief case. We know who's gonna lose, and fry him if that's your dedication. Instead, the feds have preempted those trials, which might have been clearer, and what we know is that we're not going to hear anything about the FBI's relationship in this whole episode, the whole long story. That to me is the main point about this process. It's been pared down, and there's another major thing here. You guys have been talking about it in these other subjects you've been discussing this morning, but this whole point that it's the FBI and the feds who control all the information. They are not only, they have wiretaps and interviews and tips and cases over the years. They've got a giant bank, probably bigger than the Verizon, you know, phone call file. But moreover, they tell the stories. And for so many years, the story that we heard through people like Mike Barnicle was, Whitey's a good bad guy. He's not a bad, bad guy. There are no drugs in South Boston. He keeps them out. You know, he had that bad LSD experience in federal prison, but he's doing his best to get the Italian mob out of the North End, and he's helpful to us. We must tolerate him.
But do you not appreciate that?
Hold on. Sure. But just notice how the whole narrative drama, the story, has changed. He is now a one-man weapon of mass destruction. He is Kaiser Sose. He is explosive. He is volcanic. He is almost nuclear in his violent capacity. That's the problem. And it's so huge. It's so out of proportion to any other kind of evil we know. We're not even going to bother with his relations with his brothers, his drug dealing in South Boston and control of it elsewhere. We're going to keep it narrow about this sort of unimaginably evil character. That's all FBI storytelling.
Well, except let me say, I think the irony ultimately may be that the man who outs the story that you're concerned is not being outed, and I think Marjorie and I agree with you, is Bulger himself. And even though this judge...
Which one?
The story about Whitey. The FBI and all... Whitey himself, when he takes the stand, it is true.
Wouldn't you love to hear him on the stand for days?
It is true.
Yes.
I wish I could hear him live. It is true that both the current judge and her predecessor had denied the defense motion to allow him to testify about the alleged immunity he had been granted. But I don't buy the notion that despite that ruling, with which I also disagree, that he doesn't have the ability on the stand, his last gasp, to essentially indict lots of the agencies who were his collaborators, enablers, that, you know, all that sort of thing. You know, the other, you know, Peter Galzinis was with us the other day from the Herald, and he was mentioning a variation on a theme, and I hope I get this right, Marjorie, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, is the Justice Department, which is now leading the charge against that monster, as you described, to bring justice to the victims, is the same Justice Department that works so hard to deny compensation to the victims, the same victims they care about so deeply, when they filed their civil litigation. So it's almost like an Alice in Wonderlandian kind of thing. But you're right, there is this focus, almost laser-like, on this mythical monster serial killer that causes us, I guess, to lose focus on the bigger picture. But you know what it fits into, Chris Lydon? What we're talking about this Verizon phone record collection, is people, in my estimation, the majority of people are willing to give government a pass big time. Government malfeasance, whether it's in the Whitey Bulger situation, whether it's in data collection, whether it's in failure to discover or follow up on Tamerlan Tsarnaev, our willingness to forgive and forget what government does that is unkind or, if not evil, is epic as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
You don't agree with that?
Well, I'm intrigued by it. I don't know how you know, what the number
is. Well, I don't know what the number is either.
And I don't know which way it's trending, Jim. That's the interesting thing.
I think it's trending in the wrong direction because post 9/11 and then post April 15th this year, the notion continues to build. Larry Tribe said it to us. If you challenge any of this stuff, he doesn't agree with this, you're unpatriotic. You don't care about security.
I wonder. I mean, I think we're all becoming more and more aware that the eye of Uncle is everywhere, absolutely everywhere, under every bush in Afghanistan. I mean, there's no escape. The phone numbers, past records, email, my computer, you name it, but everywhere. It's full-time, it's interplanetary, you know, not a leaf drops.
But Christopher Lyon, I want to ask you this because you did a lot with Billy Bulger, the former Senate president, who, of course, is you didn't do anything untoward. You know a lot about him, and you covered the 75 State Street, which I don't really want to get into. It's very complicated. But what I do want to ask you about
75 State Street was simple, and we should talk about it.
Okay, we should talk. But there's your argument, I think, in part two, talks about the fact that there's going to be no discussion of the allegedly unholy relationship between Whitey Bulger, the gangster, and Billy Bulger, the most powerful at one point in Boston politician around, and what one was doing for the other during their kind of both leading, Whitey leading the gangster land and Billy leading the political land.
Well, I think that's the big story that will, I think it's going to be the third great book out of Dick Lehrer and
Jerry O'Neill.
I mean, I think that will be the coup de grace, the final stage. Howie recognized it instantly years ago. I mean, he calls it the crime family.
Howie Carr.
But there's a lot of detail, I suppose, to be filled in. I mean, don't we all fantasize about, dream and hope that somehow chaos will break out in that federal court? People start really screaming, okay, no, now we're going to talk. But I don't think
we're not going to hear it even if it happens. That's part of the problem.
Well, let me digress to one other thing, not 75 State Street, but there's another piece that I think makes a sort of cosmic issue of the whole thing. We don't dwell enough on the fascinating parallel between Whitey Bulger and Osama bin Laden. And I'm deadly serious about this. I mean, these were both creatures of our federal security establishment. You know, pick up Whitey to get the gang, the Italians out of the North End, pick up Osama to get the Russians to enlist, you know, Islamic fighting power to get the Russians out of Afghanistan. The jobs get done. I mean, the Angelos are in jail. The Russians are gone. We lost interest. Osama got upset. And then in a very similar way, these two figures, Ronald Reagan called them, you know, they're the founding fathers, the freedom fighters of their world, the Osama Mujahideen sort of people. Suddenly they are towel-headed monsters, global killers, you know, the restoring, you know, kind of Muslim rule to half the world. We're such suckers in both of these cases for the line. And furthermore, nobody goes back and says, wait a second, who hired Osama? Whose idea was that? That he'd be fun, he'd be useful, he'd be helpful out there. And who called it? Who told us that, you know, Whitey was our friend, would be... I find it striking that it's a matter of transparency, it's a matter of accountability, it's a matter of skepticism. But furthermore, you know, you were saying, what do we do about it? I say the first step for a lot of us has got to be stop reading the people who fooled you the first time.
Yeah.
Stop reading those close to the CIA. We don't want to name people like Tom Friedman
Mike
Barnacle.
Is Tom Friedman close to CIA? I didn't know that.
Well, I mean, the people who championed these wars in the
Iraq
first place.
War.
Let's go get them. And these are the people who will do it. We have sort of, to me, the most amazing scandal in a certain way is that the information establishment is still very much the same
old
game.
Hold on. One of the great ironies to me about the whole Whitey Bulger as the informant to the FBI is that the reason they went after him is because the FBI was obsessed with getting La Cosa Nostra, getting rid of the mafia. Whitey Bulger really didn't give them any information on the North End and Angiulo brothers because it wasn't that close to them. Stephen Flemmi, his partner in crime, was the one, being an Italian, who had the information. Whitey John Conley, according to all these books that I'm reading, was basically making up a lot of the stuff that Whitey was supposedly telling him about the mob in the North End just to cover his covering of Bulger.
Yeah, it was good for his business. It was good for Whitey's. I also always feel there's some strange hero worship, virtually an almost, shall we say, homoerotic relationship between John Conley and the toughest guy in South
Absolutely.
Boston.
Absolutely, I mean, love it.
There's something there. There's incredible hero worship.
Let's talk about the other toughest guy in South Boston for just the final couple of minutes here. Bill Bulger will not be tried in federal court, as far as we know, for anything.
Right.
Let's assume you were to bring charges in front of, let's say, Judge Judy, for example, Chris Lydon. It's the only place we can go. What would the first three charges against the unindicted brother of Whitey Bulger be?
Oh, Jim, I'm not qualified, A, and B, I think it's more, a human, brotherly thing than a legal thing. I don't know what the legal vulnerability of Bill Bulger would be, but certainly the Ted Kaczynski model, we've talked about this before. I mean, the human responsibility to say, look, that guy's dangerous. I knew it, you know, when we were 5 years old. I've got to act. I've got to speak. I've got to identify myself. You know, yank him out of that rut of denial.
The image that I'm dying to see, and I'm assuming that once the trial actually starts, once opening arguments happen, allegedly next Wednesday, but who knows, probably a little later than that, I'm operating under the assumption that the Bulger brothers will be in the courtroom. Are you not? They were during his first appearances when he was arraigned, when he was brought back from Santa Monica. And I have to say, the image that I'm most sorry that I'm missing by not being in the courtroom, because obviously, as we know, there are no photographs, there's no video, none of that, no television coverage, is no radio coverage, live at least, or not live, is the image of the brothers Bulger sitting in the front row in the seats reserved for his family, just feet away from the victims and the guy who was on the lam for 16 or whatever number of years. That image to me, these old men sitting there is just so powerful to me. It's overwhelming. Not really. I mean, it isn't because finally, you know why? I guess let me articulate it a little bit. I think the reason is because the line was that Bill Bulger had nothing to do with Whitey Bulger other than the fact that they shared some family thing. But when you see them in physical proximity, which I have never done, and only those in the courtroom have done, don't you think it changes the whole dynamic in terms of people? I do. I think it creates a visceral connection that is deep and, I would say, quite wonderful.
Yeah, you remind me of Bill Bulger on television on 60 Minutes talking to Morley Safer and sort of saying that he says a prayer every night that Whitey won't bring any more trouble on himself. And you think, oh, my God. What should be indicted there is not just Bill Bulger, but Morley Safer and Don Hewitt. How can you put that dreck on the air, that total nonsense? It makes me sick.
Your great line from – I said it when we discussed Bulger about 6 or 8 weeks ago, but I'll say it one more time. Chris, when the Bill Bulger book came out, what was it called, The Band Plays On?
Or
that was
something.
Dance
with the Girl Who Brung
Whatever
You, or something.
I happen to be
Shamrocks
speaking to Chris Lydon, and Chris Lydon's great line that I will repeat as often as I have an opportunity was, this is the first book in American history that will be remaindered before its publication date. That was a fine line, was it not?
Yeah, I like Peter Sellers' line about the difference between the two brothers. He said, Peter Sellers, the theater director, and I said, why in the world would you care? He said, no, the story is so fascinating. Why? Because it's always told as a story of the good brother and the bad brother.
Exactly.
And you take a moment's look and you realize it's about the bad brother and the really bad brother. And the really bad brother was president of the state senate.
And the president of UMass. Hey, Chris Lydon, great to see you as always. We really appreciate your time.
We've been talking with Christopher Lydon. He comes and talks with us every Thursday. It's Thursday today, is it not? Yes, it is. At 1 o'clock. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, open mic is with Emily Rooney. Okay, up next, all you T-riders, all you commuter rail riders, all those who like to ride more trains and buses, Beverly Scott, the general manager of the MBTA, joins us to take all your calls. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Kids growing up in poverty know that graduating high school and going to college is almost everything. you don't have a college degree, you're always living paycheck to paycheck, struggling. And then you always end up doing something you don't want to do.
I'm Kai Risnall, looking forward to graduation day on our series One School, One Year. Next time on Marketplace, it's from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Before Midnight, starring Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy as Jesse and Celine, a couple vacationing in Greece who continue exploring their relationship after their romantic meeting 18 years ago, starts Friday. And Newbridge on the Charles in Dedham. This active senior community in a natural setting offers something for everyone. You can find out what many seniors have already discovered at experiencenewbridge.org.
You are listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. A lot of dancing going on in the studio, and I am not one of the dancers. She's been the general manager of the MBTA for just months, already dealt with budget battles, with huge innovation. Joining us to answer all of your questions and ours is that GM, Beverly Scott. Beverly, it's great to see you again.
It's a pleasure, absolutely.
So do you think you'd last this long?
Well, I'm still in there hanging in. Yeah, I kind of thought I might.
I had a feeling you would, too.
So, Beverly Scott, not to start with a selfish question, but, you know, what's the point of having a radio show if you can't start with a selfish question from time to time? I am obsessed with knowing how many trains now and how many lines will tell you. Say you're standing in Arlington Street or you're standing at Charles Street or wherever and you're waiting for the train to come in. Those little signs that will say the train is coming in 5 minutes, in 3 minutes, in 1 minute. How close are we to having that system-wide?
Well, now the Green Line is a separate issue, okay? And that's going to take a different technology, and we're working on that.
Because the trolleys?
Yeah, right, and it's the age of the system, and you can't just, so that one's going to take it takes a special R&D that we're doing on tracking technology for that. But we are working, and it's our intention to wind up being able to bring that up in 2015 and 2016.
Really?
Okay? Oh, yeah, we're working, okay. Now, on the others, we're everything but about two stations on terminal lines now that we've been able to bring everything up. So we've got close to, I want to tell you, I think it's about 50
wow.
of total. So, I mean, really, the group has been moving. We just added the last tranche, like, probably about a month ago, okay? And we're just down now to where we're just about at terminal stations, and that's going to be the last ones, and we'll have everything else up on the rest of the system.
How great.
That is the voice of Beverly Scott. She's the general manager of the T. And by the way, if you have questions for her, the number to reach her is 877-301-8970. I interrupted you, Marjorie. Did I?
No, I was just saying I was excited about that.
And how cool is that? And
the very thing cool. That, and for your blood that, pressure. Very cool.
It is. Yeah. And the thing that's so great about it is that it didn't have anything to do with me. The innovation, and actually the MBTA received nationally an innovation award from the public transportation industry for how, as a kid, as the young people would say, I won't say kids, way cool it was because they really broke the business model and did not require all of this, like, we have to be the only ones that do it. You have to sign every license. It's got to be proprietary. So literally what the T did, no joking aside, was to say, look, we're going to wind up working with the private sector. We're going to work with the developers that are out there. We're going to leverage the existing infrastructure that we have, and then we're going to let the marketplace work with us so that we don't try to lock every thing down and say that it's proprietary. So you can come and let's see what we can't do. And because of that, they were able to do it very quickly, very innovatively, very smartly, and with, when I tell you, very little cost outlay, things that people have been talking about would be millions and millions of dollars for the T to have done it a traditional mode, have been able to get up and operational I want to tell you, we probably ourselves have put in less than $250,000.
You know, speaking of user-friendly, one more thing, and then we're going to get to some calls, 877-301-8970 for the general manager of the T, that, of course, is Beverly Scott. Also, a change was made to this alert system you have, right? My understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, I know you will, you text, you email information about alerts on certain lines, but up until recently, you got flooded with alerts on every line. Now you can go somewhere, say, I ride the green, I ride the red, I ride the whatever, and those are the only alerts you get? Is that the deal?
Absolutely, absolutely. So that was, we started out in 2007, which was still very innovative, very revolutionary, okay, in terms of the tea being out there in 2007. So see, a lot of times people say, oh, we old, we this and that, but there's a lot of creativity going on. Anyway, up until like the last couple of months, you basically got everything, okay? You just got loaded. And we still have 50,000 subscribers. Now what you can do is you can really be personalized. Exactly what Jim is saying is like, you can do about what you care about. So I don't want to hear about, I'm a 1 in the 55. I want to understand what's happening on the 1 in 55. I don't want to know. And I'm going to tell you basically these are the time frames that I'm very concerned, that I'm interested in. And those are the alerts that you will get. Now, what I do want to say, and probably all the subscribers know this already, but please go to MBTA.com because you need to, for the 50,000 who have been subscribers, you have to re-register to be hooked into this new Google enhancement. And I'm sure people who use it all the time have done that, but we just say it's very easy, but please go in and re-register so that you can personalize the information that you receive and you just don't get glutted with everything.
Beverly Scott, I want to get to the call, as we boasted, we all three do, but one last thing for me. Last time I saw you was right around the time of the budget battles, where you guys were talking about what your deficit was, what you were looking for from the legislature, dealing with your board of directors, I think, in April. I can't even remember. Has that thing been resolved on Beacon Hill, or you're still operating with a deficit with your fingers crossed?
We are still waiting. We are very cautious. We are very optimistic. You know, we're optimistic, but we do not have the final decisions.
So you can't rule out fare increases or any of that kind of thing until the legislature acts?
No, and I want to be very clear that that was about the current budget, FY 2014. We've got 2015, and all of the plans have said that there are going to be increases that wind up taking place on all user fees every couple of years in as we move forward, but we still do not have the answers.
Our number is 877-301-8970. That's Beverly Scott, head of the D.
And our email address is bpr@wgbh.org. Let's start with Anne Marie from Boston. You are on, Anne Marie. What's your question about the MBTA?
Okay, well, we're retired military, and somebody told us the other day that if you have a military ID card, you can ride the MBTA for free. We have born and raised here, have never heard of this.
I have not either, and I have in the here with me a gentleman who's been here many, many years. We don't do that, okay? And that is with all due respect for all of our military veterans, but we do not have a discount or a free program for military veterans.
Anne Marie, sorry that that's the answer, but that's what it is. Thank you for your call. Who does ride free on the T, Beverly Scott?
We do have some pilot programs that we have for in a senior disability community. Mm-hmm. It's a program that we have been piloting for the last couple of years to see whether or not you can get a migration of individuals from the ride program to actually use regular conventional services. But other than that, I mean, we have there's really not a lot that's
ridership is down a little than last year, even though it's down less than the projections had been. Is that because of fare increases? Why is ridership? I think it was 1 or 2% or something like that.
Well, the major reason for the fact that actually overall ridership is up. Okay, and I'm saying that's just because overall ridership is up, and in fact, over the last 10-month period of time, we have probably had the most consistent in terms of annual, for average weekday ridership, we're running over 1.3 million passengers.
So what did I read? I did read
that there was some. Whenever you put a fare increase in, and this was such a major fare increase, we had an estimate going into the fare increase that we were going to lose roughly about 5.5% in terms of ridership, okay? What's actually wound up happening is that we had nowhere near that loss. We wound up, in terms of projection, so far 10 months through, we're running a little bit less than 2%, so which is why our revenue has been higher at this point than what we anticipated. We think we're going to close at about $16 million up overall. So what I would say to you is that the shrinkage in ridership that we projected is much less than we projected, and we think that's attributable to a number of things. One is how much people really do use and value the service. But there's been so much going on with the bad weather this year, as well as what wound up happening with the bombings.
After the marathon.
Yeah, after the marathon, that has been just really screwy. Plus, remember, 2012, which was a base year all these projections were based on, was a very, very warm year.
Stephen wants to know that apparently last Friday there was a Blue Line had a serious problem that stranded lots of people. He says thousands. But we didn't know about the problem until after paying our fare and entering the system. Why don't you tell people at the entrance that there's a problem before they pay and enter? You know what he's talking about?
Yeah, I know what he's talking about in terms of what happened on the Blue Line. I wasn't familiar with the fact that customers felt as though they had not received as timely information. And what I can say to you is that whether it would be that or any other, that will just be something that we'll have to do better with. And I will definitely make sure and talk with our operating team.
Let's go to George, who is in JP. You are on next with Beverly Scott. Hey there, George.
Hi there, Beverly. This is George Z. We rode on the trial run of.
Oh, George, how are you?
Oh, you rode
doing?
On the Cape Cod Flyer. Well, we don't want to hear what she has to say. She's biased. What do you think of it? Marjorie and I are dying to do the Cape Cod Flyer. We talked to Rich Davey. Tell us why.
Beverly, I hear that it's a little faster than we went.
Yes, it
they,
is.
They got the trackage better.
George, it's actually some of the additional little slow restrictions are coming off. And it was like, it's like been like two snaps. It's just, you talk about it, George.
I'll
be quiet.
George.
I cannot tell you how much fun we had that day. It was a trial run the week before it started. I haven't been on that stretch of track in a really long time. And we just had a ball.
What was fun about it? The food? The views?
No, wait a second. Yeah, the Secretary of Transportation told us what was fun about it is there was a bar car. Is that correct, George? That's right, right?
Well, unlike a lot of the Purple Line, it does have food and drink.
Mm-hmm.
The views along the marshes after you get and going over the Cape Cod Canal Bridge, the train bridge, is just spectacular.
I can't wait,
go along the canal. I'm just hoping that a lot of people will take it. I know it's just weekend service, but I have a cottage on the Cape and living in JP, and I'm hoping some of my friends will make use of it.
We're into it too. Marjorie and I have been talking about it a lot. George, thanks for the call.
Thank you, George. Did you eat the pretzel when you were on?
He's gone.
Oh, they have like specialty. Like what they did is that in the bar car. But the period we rode, there was only coffee and stuff like that. But anyway, in the bar car, one of the things they're doing, I think they've done a Cape beer. They couldn't really get a wine, but they've done a Cape beer. And then they have like specialty pieces that local businesses in the Cape have done.
That's a great.
So they had like these Picasso pretzels that are like with chocolate dipped with all these little things. Oh, my God. You talk about sinful.
Really?
Yes.
Hey, Beverly Scott, one of the things in the years we have been talking about the TV here in our prior radio life, one of the most constant complaints is how early the T shuts down. I think we talked about there was some experimental money, at least in the larger transportation plan that the governor filed, and it's been pared down, as we know, by the House and the Senate. What's the prospect for later T service?
Well, I'll tell you, everything is still on the table because we don't know at the end of the day what the sausage
is going to be.
So what we have built into the big way forward was that there's $25 million that was, quote, for expansion of service, any kind of expansion of service. Didn't have a flavor on it. And then there's $200 million that we have in there for new services. And we talked about those as being bus rapid transit potential applications, as well as things like diesel multiple units, which would be like an overlay to regular commuter service. So those are the dollars that went in that were the open dollars, if you will, going in. So roughly about $225.
What's an actual cost? What's the actual cost of a ride on the subway, for example? The total cost, subsidy included, whatever, to the T itself. What's the cost?
What's the cost of the total ride to wind up? I will get back with you on
Let's assume whatever it is. Let me guess that I'm making up a number. $5. Let's say it's $5.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why can't you extend nighttime service at $5 a pop? And say to people, this is what it costs us. We need to break even. We will do this at $5. If after 6 months it's clear you're not willing to pay it, even though it's a lot cheaper than taking a cab home from a bar at midnight, if it doesn't work out, then we got to can the service. Basically put it on the customer. Put it on the person who wants the expanded service and let them pay.
Do you know what? That is absolutely a potential. And what I would say to you is that just so people get a general sense of it in terms of what the user is actually paying for the service right now across the board is that roughly about 65% of the service. This is not every service mode, okay, because paratransit is different, but roughly only about 35% of the cost of the actual trip is what is coming from the users of the service, okay? So your point, which would be, let's just say it's $10, or seven or whatever. And if you want to do that trip, sure, that's a possibility in terms of a premium. So what I'll tell you is that the late night service as a potential on the weekends, and we've talked about Friday and Saturday night as being nights that would
be a great start.
Would be starter kind of nights, okay, with maybe doing something that might be an extension of no more than maybe about an hour to two, because I'm going to tell you where another natural constraint comes in, so let's just work with it and be honest. For us to do our maintenance, because of the quite candidly, not having the expanded facilities that you'd want, we literally have an absolute constraint where we have to lock the system down to be able to do the maintenance that's required to be able to make the service.
Because they're old trains?
Not
old
trains,
because
I don't have enough facilities to be able to say for maintenance that I can just wind up. That's, and the fact that I don't have additional, which you just call a whole bunch of additional equipment. So there are some natural constraints that the T has. If somebody said right now, Bev, go on out here. Here's it. Y'all just go on and that's run 24 it. Hours, okay? I will tell you we got natural blocks. I don't have enough equipment. I don't have enough facilities, and we couldn't do it.
Do you ride the T?
Yeah, oh, God.
Every day?
Just about every day. I'm the one in the 55, and I have no automobile, and it is my chariot, okay? Well, I tell you, initially, I was going to do one and then transfer. I love all the modes, okay? But I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and I did three buses to go to school. I didn't have yellow school buses and walked, okay? So I'm a bus kind of person. I like to see where I'm going. So I've usually always been bus. And I always kind of feel like buses, I say this all the time, it's like the Rodney Dangerfield of transit. Don't get no respect, but carries most of the trips. Now here we carry about one third on bus. So I am a bus person. So anyway, I deliberately located where I live because I knew I wasn't bringing a car, and I wanted to be able to see and be able to do so. I got my one. So I figured I was going to transfer. So then when I'm on the one the first day, our operator tells me, Terry, he says, did you see that right across the street over there? He said, you see that island over there? I said, yes. He said, did anybody tell you anything? Did you talk about the 55? I hadn't even looked at all the schedules. I know everybody. I said, well, no, because I was just going to go to... He said, well, madam, it was hilarious. He said, when you walk across the street, he said, there's a 55. You're at that transportation building, aren't you? I said, yeah. He said, your chariot has arrived. And it does. It goes directly. It's like, I could have planned this better if I'd really planned it.
So that's Beverly Scott. She is the general manager of the T. Let's take a few more calls, Marjorie,
Let's
for
go
Ms.
to
Scott.
Benny in Brighton. Hello, Benny.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello, Benny. How are you?
Great. It's a privilege to talk to you, Ms. Director.
Thank you. A privilege to speak to you as well.
I'm all for paying extra for a night bus, that's for sure. It's better than no bus at all.
Okay, okay.
But my question is about my area. I live between Cleveland Circle and Commonwealth Ave.
Okay.
And I understand you have to wait for the trolleys to stop running to run this thing, but there's this white tractor, kind of rusty, with a boom arm. And it goes by my house and several other residences. And this thing, I'm sure if my car was as loud as that thing, it wouldn't pass inspection.
Okay.
I don't think any vehicle in Boston is as loud as this tractor. And it runs at 1, 2 in the morning, and it does its return trip about 3 or 4 in the morning.
Okay.
And... if you could put a muffler on it, that's
I will tell you that I'm going to say it almost just like that, okay? Benny, I promise you that I actually will be sitting down with ops and just explaining to them exactly what you said to me. It's been like, it's not music to your ears.
Hey, Benny, don't go away. Stay on hold. One of our producers is going to take your phone number and then the T. Can you be in touch with
it,
Benny?
Absolutely. And thank you so much, Benny.
Hey, Benny, thanks for calling. Marjorie, I cannot believe we've been with Beverly Scott this long and you have not asked the noise question that consumes you. Just do it.
Oh, well, the question about the Boylston Street Station, you know, the Green Line. You've been to the Boylston Street Station. There's a squeak. That is just, I mean, you have to put your fingers in your ears. You know what I'm talking about. And I've been told that there's nothing to do about the squeak because the tracks are too old and the trains are too old. And we're just going to squeak until we take our last breath. Beverly Scott, is that true?
Well, it is old. Okay, I'm saying, no, honestly,
it's like fingers on a chalkboard.
It's the track geometry. It's part of the. I'm sure close. I can't tell you it's 100. It might be that it's 85 or whatever. But it's a track geometry. That's what it is.
Yeah, the curves.
There's no oil. There's no. You know, there's no
WD-40.
There's no WD-40 that I know of that
can
go in there.
In the last month or so, or several months, didn't a whole bunch of brand new cars come in?
Let me tell you, we are cooking. Okay, and I'm saying, so this is on commuter rail. So the Hyundai Rotem cars. This is the commuter rail. We've got a group of them that are in production right now. So anyway, we're in our recovery plan. All of them will in fact wind up being delivered by May of next year. And the cars are being done by Hyundai, but their final assembly is in Waco outside of Philadelphia. So we just wound up putting the first cars in revenue service about a month ago. We have all the way up to 10 now. We keep bringing in our little litter, okay? We have an absolute commitment that we will have 15. I know this, okay? I'm saying because it's like, you know, it's like white on rice. You know, it's like, yeah. We will have 15 in September so that we can wind up making sure that this Worcester service gets expanded in, you know, October, November, okay? But the reality is that we'll have all 75 of them in here, and that is going to mean that we will, in fact, have... And for the commuter rail service, joking aside, by the time that next May comes, we will have done a 20% of new cars that will be in the regular coaches. And then on the locomotives, okay, the locomotives we were able to, those are in production right now. The first of those will wind up coming out in January of next year. So give it to you. In terms of total locomotives, we have 82, okay? At the end of the day, 40 of the locomotives over the next 18 months will in fact wind up being new.
Wow.
And so that's a function of, so just saying that the overall quality of the service is going to be just significant. I mean, it's going to be significantly enhanced. And then with the way forward, coming over to the orange, those 121 orange line cars and the red line cars, as soon as this way forward gets booked, okay, it is on our agenda. I'm saying absolutely, swear to God, to get the procurement for the orange line and it's the orange line cars, everything gets replaced. Okay?
Now we know that Rich Davey jumped over a turnstile to apprehend a toll evader. Have you done that?
No, I haven't jumped up to grab them this way. I think I'll have to wind up doing a slide or something like that.
Let's take another call for Beverly Scott, general manager of the T. Marjorie.
Let's go to Chris in Sherbourne. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Chris.
Hi there.
Hello. How are you?
Hello. Hi, Ms. Scott. Good to talk to you. Oh, this is really good, because I've wanted to talk to somebody from MBT for so long. I live out in the suburbs. There are a lot of people who live out in the suburbs. They got money.
Yes.
They want to come into the city and see theater and concerts and eat in restaurants and that kind of thing. But you've already brought it up, but we're stopped by that last train. You know, there was a last train.
No, that is one, honestly, our folks, in terms of when I talked about that, like basically 225 that was put in the way forward to say, what can we do, some innovative things, the whole piece of looking at late night service, and I've been honest, our team has basically been focused on that Friday and Saturday night. That certainly is one of the ones that we have been running numbers on in terms of what options are, and we hear you. We're absolutely a destination. We have the beauty and the benefit of having a wonderful, wonderful capital city. It's got all of these attributes, and to be able to have everybody be able to enjoy them would be a great thing.
Thank you so much for the call, Chris. Beverly Scott, we only have a minute left here. So what's, other than new cars, you just described new locomotives. And by the way, if anybody we don't get to on hold,
emails as well, we haven't gotten to.
We'll take your phone number if you don't hang up. We'll give it to the T and to Beverly Scott, and they will promise they will get back to you, including email. What's going to knock our socks off other than new cars that you know is going to happen? And let's say in the next year and a half, what's on the horizon? What's on the planning board?
Oh, what's going to knock your socks off? It's going to be, you're definitely going to wind up seeing us put the new cars out there. The other thing is that we're going to have, we're also going to wind up going in terms of the bus fleet, and we're truly at this point in time as part of our commitment relative to the Green Dot Initiative. I honestly say it to you, I've been talking with our team about being able to, on the fleet mix, take an absolute leap and go ahead and go to a hybrid fleet, okay? Right now we have a combination. We have diesel. We have compressed natural gas. We have just a few in terms of hybrids. But to honestly see whether we could not make the commitment to go ahead and just go ahead and do it, okay? And so on the paratransit side of the house, I think what you're going to wind up seeing is some real innovation. There was a governor's commission, a 530 commission that talked about things that we could do more smartly altogether in terms of human and social services coordination with the paratransit ride services that we have, which would be a very different business model. That work will be continuing and, in fact, is kicking off again as of tomorrow. So I think you're going to start seeing some real pilot programs, some real, you know, real chunky things that we do differently. I'm hoping that we will, in fact, be able to introduce a totally different business model in terms of diesel multiple units, which is a self-propelled locomotive, which gives you an ability to wind up being able to take, like you hear us talk about the Fairmont corridor, where you don't have to have the whole commuter rail train, okay? And you can literally wind up doing a very different kind of a business model there. I think that not, I don't think, I can assure you and the public that we are not going to stop at all in terms of continuing with transportation reform and making sure that in terms of internal productivity and cost containment that we keep our eye on the bottom line. And that is an absolute commitment to our public and to our customers. So that just like this year, we came into the year with a $140 million gap. We said, look, we can do some more to do some trimming on our end, and we brought that down to $118 million. And that's because of the focus in terms of reform.
Beverly Scott, thank you.
It's great to see you, Beverly Scott.
For being with us. Beverly Scott is the general manager of the MBTA.
Hey, before you go away, is there an email for you? If people have questions, or in addition to who was on the line, how do they get in touch with you directly?
bscott@mbta.com.
And dangerous.
That's right. And I have my regular friends. That's exactly. So please join them.
At MBTA.com, you said,
yes,
correct?
Yes, bscott@mbta.com.
Beverly Scott, great to see you. See you soon.
Okay. Well, up next, when it comes to creativity, is it something some of us are born with and some not? Is it a trait we can cultivate? Karen Miller joins us for that conversation next on WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Some places it's not about predicting conflict, it's more about wondering how long it can go on.
At the moment, the situation in the Middle East is just so volatile with everything shifting. It's like a major earthquake and you don't quite know when it's going to stop.
Volatility in Syria and Turkey. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Boston Pops with Keith Lockhart, the Music City Hitmakers, and Tanglewood Festival Chorus, honoring our troops with a country twang June 13th through 15th. Tickets and info at bostonpops.org. And Harvard Summer School. You can enhance your resume, work toward a degree, or learn for enrichment. 300 courses from organic chemistry to beginning Sanskrit to Shakespeare. Registering through June 27th. summer.harvard.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim and Marty. You know, everybody wants to be a creative thinker, but let's face it. Some of us are, Steve Jobs, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Edison, some are not. But for the nots, the question is, can creativity be learned or trained? Here to help us explain whether that's possible is Karen Miller. She's host of Innovation Hub, which you can catch tonight at 9 and Saturday morning at 10. Hello, Kara.
Hi. How's it going? So, yeah, we actually talked for Saturday's show. We talked to Dr. Roberta Ness, who's actually the dean of the University of Texas School of Public Health. And what got her thinking about this was thinking about scientific advances, and she actually felt like America was falling behind in terms of creativity. And there are actually, I didn't realize this, but there are apparently tests of creativity, and you can look back 10, 20, 30 years, and we are actually becoming less creative people.
Oh.
Yeah. So she looked at ways.
Are the Chinese more creative, too? Like they're beating us and everything else?
I don't know about that. Okay. I don't know about that. But there's no question that school systems like Singapore are acutely aware that they tended to, in the past, emphasize rote learning. Uh-huh. And that the only way, I mean, you know, Jim mentioned Steve Jobs, the only way you're going to become the next Steve Jobs is to have some rote learning, but also a lot of creativity. So she's looked at this way of bringing creativity into the curriculum. I'll give you a question here. Are you ready for it?
We're ready.
No.
Okay. Well, it's going to exercise your creative juices, Jim. So get ready.
Okay.
Water lilies double in number every day. It takes 60 days for the lilies to cover a pond. On what day is half the pond covered?
I know the answer.
God, forget that.
I know the answer.
Go ahead.
Tuesday. I have no idea.
So that's actually the 59th day, right? If lilies double every day and they fill the pond on the 60th day, then what day is half the pond filled? The day before the day it's filled. Okay.
So what's the point of that exercise?
So the point is to sort of get you
out. That took me half an hour.
And, you know, Marjorie picked up her pen, right? The idea is to sort of break you out of the way you normally do things.
Yep.
And one of the things she does is emphasize these kinds of exercises. So one really creative person she talks about is a researcher at NYU. And one of the things he noticed is that people are awful at saving for retirement, right? Because they know they should. They know they should. No. They know it intellectually. But the now is so much more important than the then that they tend not to do it. And the other thing is they tend to think of themselves then, 20, 30, 40 years in the future, as like different people. So what he did was he took a picture of you, of me, of all sorts of people, and he showed in the research aged enhanced photos of yourself to you.
I don't want to see those.
And so instead, so it gets a little scary. But the other thing is you realize like it is like Marjorie, in 20 years, I'm going to be 20 years older. It's not a different person. It is me, and I'm going to need money. And when they were showed these age enhanced pictures of themselves, they were much, much better savers.
Yeah, really? But one of the things, when I was reading some stuff in anticipation of you coming, there are complex strategies to get people to be more creative, but one of the examples that was so mundane that I found hard to believe, they said if a teacher or a supervisor presents a problem to either his or her students or staff and says, I don't want you to answer this in the traditional straightforward way, literally just says, I want you to be more creative, that all the research shows that people are more creative. Now, what is that about? Because we don't think we have permission to think outside the box, and when it's given, all of a sudden we exercise it? Is that it?
We live inside boxes, I think, so much that we can't even see outside of them. Roberta Ness talks about, you know, what would happen if you went to an Italian restaurant and you said, this is great, but I'd really like some Parmesan cheese, and the waitress said to you, okay, well, go into the kitchen and get it yourself. You would be taken aback because that is not sort of a possibility for the waitress. That is such a weird thing to do. That is outside the box. Or what would happen if you were in the theater, somebody wanted to blow their nose, so they took your sleeve and blew their nose on your sleeve.
I've done that.
Yeah, have you? Okay, well, then this is why you're such a creative person. But no, you're absolutely right. When you give people permission to say, what could this be? Instead of the way that we normally do things, what could it be? You start having far more sort of creative interactions. And actually, big companies like Google, like Apple, have actually caught on to this and try to do these kinds of set aside creative time for their employees. I mean, it's actually a very important thing to do.
And what does that mean? So what do they do in their creative time at Apple and Google?
So some of it is just observation. Some of it is working on other things. One person that people might be familiar with is actually Maria Montessori, who started Montessori schools.
Yes.
And people used to think that one of the things she realized, she was a doctor, actually. I didn't realize this. I thought she was an educator, but she was a doctor.
Yep.
And she watched little kids, you know how they like pick things up and keep dropping them on the floor and you're like, oh my God, I have to pick this up again for this little kid. And people thought, oh, they're testing gravity and whatever. And she realized, no, they don't care about the thing that they're dropping. They're watching their hands. They don't know what their hands can do and they're so excited by what they can do, they keep doing it over and over. So some of it is just watching things in ways that you never did before. Yeah.
Is everybody? Yeah. We only have a minute plus left. Yeah. Is the notion that everybody has this creative gene? I don't mean literally the gene. Well, maybe I do in them, or that some people are creative ready, and those are the ones you can reach. Meaning, if you go to a classroom or you go to a workforce, is the theory that if you do it right as a leader, you can bring out some additional creativity in everybody in the room?
Yes, yes. I mean, there are clearly more there are some people who are initially more creative, but we also do a lot of putting people in boxes, a lot of telling people, this is how you take tests, this is the right way to do things. I'll give you one last person, Jane Goodall, who you probably know, who observed chimps.
Or we wish we knew.
Before she started observing chimps, it was the conventional wisdom that chimps were extremely aggressive. The way she observed them, because she was not trained, was to hide when she observed them. That was not how any other scientists you know, did it. But the reason she did it is because she didn't know how you were supposed to do it. And it turned out the chimps aren't very aggressive at all. The reason they were aggressive is because the scientists would barge in. And, you know, and they were like, oh, my God, we're being attacked. And she realized all sorts of things about chimps, that they could make tools. People used to think only humans could make tools. But chimps would make tools to get termites out of trees.
I want you to know, before we go here, one of our producers typed into our call screen, we really live inside boxes because we keep using that metaphor, which is
I'm in a box right now, the studio.
I have a very attractive box myself.
Yeah, I do too. Pale blue. Carmilla,
it's great to see you.
Good to see you too.
And by the way, we hear your event was spectacular.
It was really fun.
Congratulations.
That's
great. We'll talk about it next week.
Okay.
What time's the show?
It's Thursday at 9 p.m. tonight, and this on Geniuses, Saturday, 10 a.m.
Terrific. We'll be listening. Kara, thanks so much, and thanks to you guys for listening. Tune in tomorrow for our Friday news quiz. We're calling it A Tale of Two Cities. Bill Brett, you know him, the society photographer, party photographer, entertainment photographer, faces off with Jim Botticelli. He's the photo blogger behind dirty old Boston. You can follow us on Twitter at BOS Public Radio, as in Boston Public Radio, or me at Jim Browdy, Marjorie at Marjorie Egan, and 24/7, we're all at WGBHnews.org/BPR. That's it for today. We'll see you tomorrow at noon. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you then.